In 2013, Cindy Porteous traveled from Indiana so she could terminate her pregnancy for medical reasons. Last year, more than 5,500 women like her came to Illinois to have an abortion.
Our doctor advised us that we could try to have that done in Indiana, but as we were past 20 weeks, we would have to go before a hospital ethics board, and she felt that they would likely deny our case.
Thanks to the Chicago Tribune for that audio. Plus, Central Illinois now has the state's first dark sky park. Here's Mary Ellen Wallner with the Champaign County Forest Preserve.
We need to preserve the night sky so that future generations have that experience that maybe we've all had of looking up and seeing a crazy star-filled sky.
But first, pension debt is still a huge problem for our state government. And now, the Illinois Supreme Court has struck down a law that was designed to limit abuses of the pension system. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay with us. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone had a good weekend. Special thanks to Liz Westfield for filling in for me last week while I was out. Coming up this hour, more women than ever are coming to Illinois to get abortions. We'll explore why. Also, we'll be talking about Illinois' very first dark sky park. But first, we know that Illinois has a pension problem. In fact, the latest numbers from the state legislature just released this past Friday have that problem at $133.5 billion. Our state government has also gone through a different legal, political and legal battles for years over how best to fix this crisis. One small fix could be limiting the amount that union bosses could receive after a Chicago Tribune investigation found some labor leaders were getting hundreds of thousands of dollars in pensions a year. That battle has taken another turn as the state Supreme Court stepped in to throw out that law. They said changes that the state house made to try to fix this were unconstitutional. Sound familiar? This has come up in the past when lawmakers have tried to offer other pension fixes. We have two reporters with us who've been following this issue for years. Ray Long is an investigative reporter with the Chicago Tribune. Also with us is Jason Grotto. He's now with ProPublica Illinois, but he first started reporting on this for the Tribune back in 2011. Hi, guys. Welcome to the 21st. Good morning.
Thanks for having us.
Jason, let's start with you. This is a complicated issue that I think is really important for everyone who's listening to understand because we're all taxpayers. And we often talk about the huge amounts of money that our state owes in its pension obligations. I wonder if you can describe specifically in this case the pensions that some union leaders are receiving them. Who's getting them and how are they getting such big pensions in the first place?
Sure. So this whole issue grew out of some tips that we received back in around 2010 regarding union leaders who were collecting both public pensions as well as pensions from their unions, which is illegal under state law. And what we found when we dug into it is that there was a law that was passed in 1991. By the state legislature that allowed union leaders who left their city or state employment to continue to they left their public employment to go work for the union, and they could continue collecting on their public pensions. But prior to 1991, those pensions were based on their city or state salaries. The law that changed in 91 was said, well, we're going to now base those pensions on the union salaries, which were much, much higher. And so that's why these pensions grew to be so high for these union leaders.
And can you give us some specific examples here, Jason? So in some cases,
sure.
I saw someone who was making $15,000 a year as a city employee, but then was making how much, maybe like $100,000 as a union leader? Is that about...
That's correct.
And then
that's
how...
That's correct. There was
one
person, Al Namoli, who's the president of the Cement Workers Union, was receiving more than $13,000 from the city pension fund a month because it was based on his $300,000 salary, union salary, when in fact he was making $15,000 a year at the city job that he held.
Right. I think they're
25 years earlier, by the way.
Yeah. Gosh. And I think people listening to this, I think everyone agrees that if you work as a public employee for the long term, you should be allowed to get a pension that helps them retire. This is something kind of different. Ray, how I think a lot of people are probably wondering how this is legal.
Well, when you get a bunch of legislators together in Springfield and get a bunch of union guys together, a lot of times they can slip in a few lines and change people's financial futures forever. I don't know that the lawmakers had the feel that it would be this much of a big windfall, but certainly it has turned out to be a real cash cow for the folks who've been able to cash in.
And Jason, do we have a sense of how many people are taking advantage of this and how much money is involved here?
At the time that we reported this, there were 23 retired union officials from Chicago alone that stood to make $56 million over the course of their lifetimes from city pension funds alone. That doesn't include people who had been working during that time and may have retired since then, and it certainly doesn't include state and union officials.
So that's just 23 people were $56 million?
That's right. Some of them would end up collecting $4 million over the course of their lifetime.
Ray,
and the issue here,
go ahead, Jason.
I was just going to say, like with the pension funds themselves, the issue is they certainly hadn't contributed enough to the fund to cover those pensions, and so that resulted in large shortfalls for those funds.
So, Ray, when lawmakers found out about this was back in 2011. How did they respond? What did they do?
Well, they thought they should change it so that there should be no more opportunities for people to cash in like this. So they scaled it back and said that you could only base this on your public salary. So when that happened, they put that law into place, and then people who would benefit from the old law decided that they would challenge the new law, and they challenge it on this basis that once your pension is set, it can't be diminished or impaired, and that's the standard that is in the Illinois Constitution. As you know, Illinois Supreme Court judges have cited that provision over and over in refusing to scale back the size of the pensions and saying that once a pension is set at a certain level, once a benefit is set at a certain level, you can't scale it back. So that has become a real thorn in the side of lawmakers who are trying to get control of the pension costs.
And I wonder, when we're thinking about just control of the cost, Ray, how does this affect when we're thinking about these numbers? Jason was giving us just, for example, the city of Chicago, $56 million probably seems like a drop in the bucket compared to how much the state owes in pension obligations. How does all of this affect state and local finances?
Well, they are trying to, all of the officials who are worried about the finances, and that's most but not all of them, are trying to figure out what type of ways they can come up with, what they can conceive to get around this provision in the Constitution, or whether they may just have to put it on the ballot to change the Constitution. Now, that's a steep bar because there are so many people now who are public employees who are in unions who don't want that changed. For example, teachers and public workers in the state and in city governments all across the state would not want those changes made. So that's a huge voting block that would be voting against any changes in the Constitution if it could even get on the ballot. So lawmakers are afraid to put a question like that up on the ballot because they're fearful that a vote that shows that they're willing to try to change this pension perk could backfire against them when they are running for re-election. So it's one of those deals where you have to get it past jittery lawmakers to put it on the ballot. Then you have to try to rally regular Joe citizens to convince their neighbors who are getting these public pensions that they should be able to scale them back. It's a very complicated process, and it's difficult to achieve.
And Jason, I wonder, as we're thinking about this issue, First of all, a couple of weeks ago, was it a surprise when the Supreme Court released this ruling saying, tossing out this law that the General Assembly passed in 2011? Ray was sort of explaining, well, we can't limit benefits. So was it a surprise that this happened?
I think it was consistent with what the Illinois Supreme Court has ruled over many years. So I don't think it was a huge surprise to those people who follow it regularly. This particular issue, because it was put in 1991, there was some hope that maybe it could change, but it is what it is. They've ruled, and now these benefits can't be taken back. Now, new union officials may not get this perk because they hadn't started collecting the benefit yet. But so going forward, it may not be an issue, but it will continue to be a liability on the state and city's balance sheets.
What has the union said about this, Ray?
Well, we reached out to them when this story came down, and we couldn't get anybody to really comment about it. But what is interesting is that the court ruling tossed out the changes for the workers and retirees who are already covered by the pension system. So if you're already on the payroll, but the ruling actually did not address whether the law has been invalidated for people who became public employees after it took effect. So I could see more potential for litigation down the road.
But in the meantime, you still have, and just to be clear, these are some union leaders. It's not necessarily rank and file, but those guys, are they continuing to then collect these giant pensions?
Yes.
Yeah. That's a good deal if you can get it.
And how does that contrast with how much pensions are owed to, say, your rank and file public sector worker or a teacher? This runs the gamut, right? About a city employee, a firefighter, a teacher. This must be a huge discrepancy, Jason.
We found at the time that it was three times higher than what the typical city worker received. What these guys were getting was three times greater. And the issue here is that the city and state don't control the salaries of these individuals. The unions do, and that's part of the issue. So as lawmakers struggle to get a handle on the costs, this is one variable that is probably the most important variable. Well, how much money do you make? Because the pensions are based on a percentage of your salary or your average salary over a certain amount of time. And that's one way where you can control the costs. But because of this, they cannot control the costs on these particular individuals.
Ray, Jason, jump in here as well. But Ray, I'm just going to ask you, I wonder what lawmakers have said to you all since this law was struck down. I imagine the folks who are interested in trying to find a fix to this would be pretty frustrated by this recent turn of events.
Well, they are frustrated. They're kind of like, gee whiz, what can we do? Is there any way we can block these windfalls from coming down? And they are frustrated. There was the big overall pension decision that was aimed at trying to scale back en masse the pension costs 4 years ago. That came down right when Governor Rauner was just winning the election he had against Governor Quinn, who tried to change it, who signed the bigger pension law into place. And that was struck down. And since then, it's just been a continual march to the Supreme Court, and anything that goes up there gets struck down too, like this. So the lawmakers are feeling a little bit hopeless about it.
And you mentioned
important.
Go ahead, Jason.
I just want to jump in. One of the things that I think it's important for people to understand is this particular law, we could find no other instance of it around the country. This idea of basing a public pension off a union salary, it's very different than what we've seen in other states.
And so that said, Ray, as you mentioned Governor Quinn, you mentioned Governor Rauner. What has incoming governor-elect J.B. Pritzker said about this situation? Do we expect that Governor-elect Pritzker or Speaker Madigan, who now has a supermajority in the Democratic House, do you think that there's any chance of things changing, or what has he said about how he would like to try to fix this?
Well, as you know, J.B. Pritzker wasn't totally detailed in all of his proposals. It's my gut feeling, and it's from also watching the legislature and Madigan over the years, that if they want to really stand up and fix this, and I think there is a desire to fix the pension system costs, because it eats into every other service, including things like education, public safety, et cetera. So if they want to do something, they have the ball now. Democrats have the ball, and they will have to figure out something, some way to do it, whether it's by constitutional amendment or by outsmarting the Constitution in the way it is now. And so far, outsmarting has not worked.
Right. I mean, it seems like whenever, it's very rare that we hear of the Illinois Supreme Court, but I feel like it's often in these cases of the pension and making things more difficult. Well, I want to thank Ray Long, who's still with the Chicago Tribune, and Jason Grotto, who's now with ProPublica Illinois. Both of them have been reporting on this issue for years, this particular issue we've been talking about this morning, as well as the broader issue. We'll tweet out those stories if you are interested in reading more about that. Jason, Ray, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Coming up, we'll be talking about the number of women who are traveling to Illinois to get abortions is growing, continuing to grow. We'll be talking about why. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st.
Support for The 21st comes from University of Illinois Press, hosting a booth at the Urbana Holiday Market in the Square December 8th and December 15th, featuring regional and special interest titles for every book lover on your list. The University of Illinois Press, celebrating 100 years.
Back to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've seen across the country many changes to the landscape of access to abortion. The Midwest is no different. A woman's ability to obtain a legal abortion varies greatly depending on what state you're in. Just this morning, the Supreme Court said it wouldn't hear a case that was filed by Kansas and Louisiana that was trying to strip Medicaid money from Planned Parenthood, obviously in terms of abortion. Here in Illinois, we actually have some of the least restrictive abortion laws, especially when it comes to our neighbors across the Midwest, and that means more women from the Midwest end up here. New numbers from the end of November show even more women are coming from outside of Illinois to have abortions here. That's according to the Illinois Department of Public Health. And how many women are we talking about? Last year, more than 5,500 women traveled to Illinois from other states to terminate pregnancies. That's almost 1,000 more women than in 2016. Tima Axel is with us to talk about this. Tima is a volunteer with the Midwest Access Coalition, a Chicago-based nonprofit that helps women with the costs associated with traveling to terminate a pregnancy. Hi, Tima. Thanks for being here. Welcome to The 21st.
Hi, Nyla. Thanks for having me.
So as I mentioned, you volunteer for this Midwest Access Coalition, which houses and helps women traveling to Chicago to terminate pregnancies. Tima, where are the women you meet coming from?
They're coming from outside Illinois, but from the Midwest. So the first woman I hosted came in from Indianapolis. The second woman I hosted earlier this year was from, I think, Green Bay. She was from Wisconsin.
And what are their stories? Do they tend to come from particular socioeconomic or racial backgrounds, or is it all across the board?
Yeah, I mean, I'll say that they were both young women in their 20s, I think, from what I recall, and they were both women of color. So the first woman was Black. I think the second woman was Latina. In terms of other things we talked about, I know that the first young woman I hosted had a family. She was a mother to a few children, had a stable job, in a place she was living, but she just felt like she wasn't going to be able to take care of another one. And in addition to that, there were medical complications she was facing that could have put her life potentially in danger if she wasn't able to access abortion back home.
And it sounds like very clearly these women thought that was the case because they came here to Illinois, which itself is a very, I would imagine, not just time consuming, but expensive.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, they both came in buses, you know. The first woman came alone on, I think, a Greyhound that was paid for by the organization I volunteer for. So I'm not sure how she would have gotten here otherwise. And then later her mother joined her to help give her some emotional support. And the second woman came over also on a Greyhound with her best friend, which is really nice to see folks traveling together, but it wasn't easy for them to get that time off of work. It wasn't, you know, they had to get their costs refunded to them because they wouldn't have been able to afford even the bus ticket on the way over here. So yeah, we're talking about people who are facing significant issues because of income and have to travel a long way and take a lot of time off just to get these basic services.
So when we're thinking about the cost, obviously it's not just the actual procedure, but it's the travel. And then I guess it's also, it sounds like, the lost cost of not being able to collect a salary while you're gone.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that the first woman was working a service job, I think, at a restaurant. So she was losing tips. She was losing wages the days that she took off. And then, of course, when they get here, they're not staying at the Ritz-Carlton. They're staying at my house, which is, you know, a very basic apartment that I share with roommates. And the best I can do is give them a room and some quiet space alone. But it's not fancy. It's free. And then we try to help them with their meals while they're here as well.
Have you seen an increase in women who need the help from Midwest Access Coalition, Timna?
You know, I'm a volunteer with them, so I really don't feel like I can speak to the numbers they've seen overall. But from what I've heard from other volunteers and from the director of Midwest Access Coalition, who I'm in touch with, yeah, unfortunately, we are seeing the number of women go up who need these kinds of services from Indiana, from Wisconsin, and other places in the Midwest.
That's Timna Axel. She said a volunteer with the Midwest Access Coalition. They're a Chicago-based nonprofit that helps women with costs associated with traveling to terminate pregnancies. Timna, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Take care.
We wanted to bring two more people into this conversation who've been following this issue. Angie Leventis-Lorgos is on the line with me. She's been reporting on this for the Chicago Tribune. Katie Watson's also with us. She's a lawyer as well as a professor of medical humanities and bioethics, and she's the author of The Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. Katie, Angie, welcome, both of you, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Great to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Katie, I wanted to just start by asking you, just as we were listening to Timna, I think there's so many preconceptions as well as misconceptions around the issue of women who get abortions. I wonder what your research shows about what these women look like, as well as the sheer number of women who are getting abortions all across the country, not just here in Illinois.
Sure. So one thing people are sometimes surprised to learn is that 59% of all abortion patients nationwide are already mothers. They're parenting other children. And so when we talk about travel, we also have to think about childcare expenses and sort of psychological issues around leaving your children behind for longer than necessary. So I think these women are paying an extraordinary abortion tax. They're paying it financially in terms of this travel and having to find a place to stay and losing time at work and childcare expenses. But they're also paying it psychologically, that stigma of border crossing. The vast majority of abortion patients are having terminations in the first trimester. And I think that that's something that's not commonly understood. And the majority are in their 20s. So these are younger women who may not have the resources, travel just might be extra daunting for them. So those are some factors that come to mind when I think about the demographics of abortion patients. Lastly, I'll add that 49% of all abortion patients nationwide have incomes under the poverty line. So these are people who are already often struggling to make rent and put food on the table. And so these added expenses are very hard to absorb. So that's why the work of groups like Midwest Access Project are so important.
Angie, I wanted to ask you about why women are coming here. When we look at the landscape of Illinois compared to surrounding states, we heard Teen Must talk about Wisconsin, Indiana. Katie, I know you were on the program most recently talking about Iowa. I'll bring that up in just a second. But what does it look like in Illinois when we think about women coming here? Why are they coming here?
Well, the data doesn't really give a reason for why people are coming from out of state. We just know the number is continually increasing. But we do know that there's a lot of restrictions in other states that surround Illinois. There's waiting periods in other states. There's gestational limits. There was a study that was done that showed that there were fewer clinics in other parts of the Midwest. So sometimes that affects distance and travel, even if maybe your state doesn't have any restrictions on when and where you can have it done. There might not be a clinic within a reasonable distance, so it might be closer to come to Illinois. There's all sorts of hurdles that are going on in Wisconsin, Indiana, Iowa, and some of those are shifting really quickly. You'll have a state pass a law, then the law will be enjoined by the courts, and it's hard sometimes to even know what the law is in your state for some of these women.
And so the data shows that almost 1,000 more women traveled to Illinois to have abortions this year than in 2017. As we're talking about that, are there some things you think that have changed even just over the past year that might have contributed to those numbers, Angie?
Well, there was a lot of a shift in Iowa. There were four clinics that closed last year, and some of those were right on the Illinois border. So there's conjecture that maybe some of those people are coming over to Illinois instead. We don't know for certain. Missouri is another place where there's a lot of shift. There were clinics that opened, and then now, just a month ago, Missouri was left with only one clinic. So that might affect who's coming to Illinois since it's right on the border. It might affect people coming to southern Illinois. And there's just a tremendous amount of shift and fluctuation in states surrounding Illinois, whereas Illinois tends to be pretty stable.
And I wanted to ask, Kitty, you about that, and Angie mentioned Iowa. Back in May, you were on the 21st to talk about Iowa's proposed heartbeat legislation. Although that was temporarily blocked, last year Iowa passed a 20-week limit on abortion. What do the laws look like? I'm thinking Ohio introduced something similar. When we're talking about restricting that, can you tell us a little bit more about what that looks like in Iowa right now?
Sure. So in Iowa specifically, it's very interesting. Iowa has a myriad bans being passed and has lots of anti-choice legislation. Angie referred to the four Planned Parenthood clinics closing. That's because Iowa made the unusual decision to pull completely out of the federal Title X funding so that they didn't have to give any Title X money to Planned Parenthood, and then they supplied $3 million of their own state money to contraceptive funding so they could distribute it how they wanted. And that is one contributing factor to why those Planned Parenthood clinics closed. On the other hand, I think it's very interesting that this June, the Iowa Supreme Court made a very unique decision. In considering a 72-hour waiting requirement in Iowa, it struck down that law as unconstitutional. But in the course of doing so, it found that women in Iowa have a fundamental constitutional right to abortion as a matter of liberty under the Iowa state constitution. That is a very new development in Iowa. So things like a 20-week ban have not yet been tested under that new state constitutional understanding in Iowa. So as Angie said, these things are really in flux in Iowa in multiple directions. Those 20-week bans are common. And
what does that mean, Katie? I think we hear a lot of these terms. When we say a 20-week ban, what does that mean?
So Roe versus Wade said states may ban abortion after viability, and they did not define that by a week because the justices understood that the medicine changes and that that's a medical determination. So when Roe was decided in 1973, the justices said that happens between 28 and 24 weeks. Neonatology has not advanced the way some people predicted, so that viability still hovers around 24-ish weeks, according to physicians.
That's when the fetus could live outside of the womb.
Well, it could, but it's not guaranteed. So when women go into premature delivery at 24 weeks, approximately 62% of those neonates survive to discharge. 9 out of 10 of them have major health problems. And the medical profession has sort of said, we're going to set viability around there. Now, these 20-week bans say, no, we're going to change our state cutoff to say you can't have an abortion after 20 weeks. That's a blatant violation of Roe. Some of them have been appealed up and overturned. Others haven't been pursued because only less than 2% of all abortions happen after that point. And so many states never had a doctor doing them to begin with because there weren't enough people who needed them. So those women were traveling anyway. So in some states, those laws become symbolic because no one was doing them in that state anyway. There's no plaintiff to challenge the law. There's no reason to waste the money on that lawsuit. But it creates a lot of confusion. In contrast, let me point out that Indiana has a legal restriction that has a lot of teeth. It says that at 14 weeks of gestation or later, abortions may only be performed in an ambulatory surgery center. That's like a mini hospital, not your standard abortion clinic. And what that means, that's very hard to maintain. And so in Indiana, any abortion after 14 weeks that's not for a threat to the life or health of the mother gets referred out of state. So almost all of those women are coming to Illinois or closer states to them to have those procedures. So there are myriad restrictions that are driving these travel patterns.
Angie, what do the resources look like in Illinois then in terms of Planned Parenthood, other facilities for these women?
There's no indication that that Illinois is going to be decreasing its services, but people that I've talked to have said Illinois is prepared to handle an influx, but I don't think we can really know what that looks like until we see how some of these states, it isn't even certain what restrictions are going to stay on the books. We don't know what some of that influx might be in the future. So I think a lot of that remains to be seen. It looks and appears like Illinois is going to remain an oasis in the Midwest, but we don't know exactly what's going to be in the future.
So it sounds like it's not just the landscape, the legal landscape of everything, how laws, whether they're symbolic or not. It's medical professionals who are referring people here. Katie, why do you think it's important to have Illinois status? We started this conversation, you're talking about the tax. You feel like some women have to, kind of an abortion tax, in other words, that some women have to go through. Why do you think having Illinois status, having so many people here, is important when we contrast that with the rest of the Midwest?
Well, as a bioethicist, I have an interest in people getting access to whatever legal health care they and their physician think is right for them. And we don't often talk about abortion through the lens of health care disparities, but I think that's the framing we should be using. We should be concerned when there are deserts of care, and that's what we're seeing in some of the surrounding states. So I wish it were otherwise in those states because people should be able to get their care locally, whether it's their, you know, knee replacement or their cataract surgery or their prenatal care or their abortion care. They should be able to get that locally. If they cannot, for whatever reason, preserving other areas of medical care where they can get it becomes critical. So it is very important that Illinois keep up its infrastructure for the health of its neighboring citizens of neighboring states. It shouldn't have to be the case. They shouldn't have to travel. But to Angie's point, if we look further down the road, if the Roe versus Wade decision is further dismantled, we are going to have a different situation. So Illinois has approximately a total of 39,000 abortion patients in 2017, according to this data, 14% of them coming from out of state, 5,000 approximately. Imagine a state like Indiana goes dark, as people say in this world, and no abortion is allowed. Suddenly those numbers become a flood.
Wow. They really could change the landscape of everything. Unfortunately, Katie,
dark.
I think we're out of time, but I appreciate you sharing some of that with us. Katie Watson is with Northwestern University and the author of Scarlet A, The Ethics, Law, and Politics of Ordinary Abortion. I want to thank Angie Leventis-Lorgas from the Chicago Tribune. Thank you, ladies.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Support for the 21st comes from Sock Club, delivering new designs of socks each month made with cotton grown and knit in the southeastern United States. Gift subscriptions are available this holiday season to keep friends and family in socks year-round. More information is available online at sockclub.com.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. There are more stars and galaxies out in space than we can wrap our heads around, but it might not look that way if you were to look up at the sky this evening, because it depends on where you live. And if you can't see the stars, that's because of light pollution, if you've never heard that term. Here in Illinois, astronomy fans have gotten some good news on that front. Late last month, the Middle Fork River Forest Preserve in Champaign County got a unique accreditation. It's officially an international dark sky park, and it's the first one in Illinois. Joining me on the line to help learn more about this is David Leake, a professor of astronomy and physics at Parkland College. He's also the director of the Starkle Planetarium. Hi, David. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, good morning. It's a pleasure to be on.
Good morning. And with us here in our Urbana studios is Mary Ellen Wallner, who's executive director of the Champaign County Forest Preserve. Mary Ellen, thanks for being here with us as well. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, David, I wanted to start by asking about, I think last time you were on the program, we were talking about the possibility of this happening. You and Mary Ellen both played a big part in helping establish an area as Illinois' first dark sky park. First, how do you feel about this designation? Is this a big deal?
Oh, yes. To me, it's a huge deal. When I heard the news, I literally jumped out of my chair. We've been working on this for quite a long time, but to me, this is a great thing for Champaign County and also the Forest Preserve District, because this is a very unique designation. There are 64 dark sky parks. I actually did the math just this morning, and 45 of those are in the United States, and we're the first one in Illinois, so this is fantastic news.
Mary Ellen, how big of a deal is it for you all, for Champaign County and the Forest Preserve, to have this?
As David said, it's a very big deal for us, too. This is something we've been working on. Really was the Champaign-Urbana Astronomical Society that brought this idea of a dark sky park to our attention. But it made so much sense for us to pursue this designation because Middle Fork River Forest Preserve is perfectly situated for such a designation. And we now feel like we can tell the rest of the world that as well.
So we have people listening all across the state. Mary Ellen, can you remind us exactly where Middle Fork Forest Preserve is?
Middle Fork River Forest Preserve is in the northeast corner of Champaign County. The closest large community to Middle Fork is Rantoul, but it's still a good distance from Rantoul, which is why you'll find that it is in the darkest corner of the state, which is what the Astronomical Society pointed out to us through their sky quality readings.
And David, can you remind us then what these sky quality readings are, and when we say the darkest portion of the state, what we mean by that? What exactly a dark sky park is?
They actually make a sky quality meter, which is an instrument that you hold up and point it at the sky, and you can measure sky brightness. It's maybe similar to what a photographer might use to measure the lighting for a photograph, similar to that. And what one of our members, John Stone, did, which is pretty genius if you ask me, is he actually hooked up one of these meters to a computer and pointed it up from the sunroof of his car, took the sunroof off, and he drove around the county, and the computer made measurements every 10, 15, 20 seconds or so. And from that, we can say with great certainty that the Middle Fork River area is really one of the darkest spots in Champaign County.
So how far away does it have to be from houses or I guess it's really development, right, David, would have lights?
That's true. But really, we want to get the word out there that it's not really a question of, hey, everybody turn your lights off. I mean, if they're not being used, then yes, then we'd like that. But it's really a matter of where you point your lights. A lot of us will turn on a light outside without real regard as to where we're shining the light. The example I like to use is you probably wouldn't take a water sprinkler to the end of your driveway and water the street because it's really a waste of water. You want to put the water where it's needed. But yet we don't think about that when we do that with our lights. So there are lights at the Middle Fork River Forest Preserve, but what the Matt Koontz, the site superintendent there, has done with his staff is they've redone all the lights where they're pointing down. They're lighting up where the areas that they need to be lit, and that's really the key.
So, Mary Ellen, what does that look like within the Forest Preserve? Because I imagine you still have to weigh that with the needs if you want folks to be camping. That's why the light was there in the first place, right?
That's correct. What we did, we took to start this process, we did an inventory of the lights at Middle Fork, and we eliminated some lights completely. As David said, when they were in places where they weren't really necessary to be at night. But the lights that are in place for both safety and accessibility of the individuals that are using the campground in particular, because there is a campground there and it's open throughout the night, those lights had to obviously stay in place. But as David said, they really need to be the right sort of light. So they need to be fully shielded, which means there's no light trespass to the side or upward from those lights. So it lights the places that need to be lit and doesn't emit excess light into places that don't. And that was really the key to us in terms of retrofitting the lighting at Middle Fork.
That's a really different way of thinking about lighting, mm-hmm. I imagine, Mary Ellen. I'm thinking when the Forest Preserve was created, when these lights were installed, no one was really thinking about that, were they?
That's absolutely right. In fact, these lights are about 40 years old, so they were some of the first lights that were put in up there. And if you can imagine going to the store and picking out a light that is probably the worst light in terms of...
a floodlight?
Well, and they're globe lights, actually. So they emit light in every direction, not just where it's needed, but in all the places where it's not. But of course, 40 years ago, they were the light that made the most sense. Now the lights look completely different. And everybody who's up there, all of the campers that have come and commented to us on the new lighting, really love this particular lighting because, like I said, it overall, the lighting at the campground is much better. It's much more, provides light where it's needed and really allows for the rest of the campground to stay dark so that you do have the benefit of that beautiful starry night sky.
That's Mary Ellen Wallner, who's Executive Director of Champaign County Forest Preserve. We've also been speaking with David Leake, who's the Director of the Starkol Planetarium. He also teaches astronomy and physics at Parkland College. As always, you're welcome to join our conversation. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. And we've got a caller, Ross from Urbana. Hi, Ross. Welcome to the 21st. I think you had a comment and a question, right?
Yes, I did. So I usually take my kids out to there. We've been at our in Champaign County for about 4 years. And we learned about Middle Fork right after we got here through a church activity, and we take our kids out there. We found there's actually it's the best area we found for looking at the stars, and we really appreciated it. But as I've told my kids over and over, it's a lot different from where I grew up, which was Idaho. And we lived in Idaho before, where we get up in around 10,000 foot elevation with a low humidity, and there's a huge difference. But, I mean, for Illinois, it's wonderful, but to really experience stars, you kind of have to get out in places like the high desert where the stars are in a whole different level. And then you can really understand, you know, you talked about seeing how many stars there are in the sky. Then you can really understand how many stars there are.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ross. I appreciate that. I'm thinking, we were talking about this in the office this morning. I was just on vacation last week in Florida, and the Florida Keys are one of the few places in Florida where you can see, and you really have to go to like the middle Keys to see everything because there's so much light from Key West. There's so much light from Miami. David, I wonder, we were also talking about, I feel like the first place I really saw stars was in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, because it's another one of those high elevation places. David, I wonder how important it was for you to be able to see stars and how much that role played in you becoming an astronomer.
Well, it actually played a very, very large role. I was probably most affected by the moon missions, which I'm maybe showing my age a little bit, but the 50th anniversary of Apollo 11 is in 2019, and that got me thinking about space. And then in fifth grade, my fifth grade teacher showed us a couple of constellations on the wall, and I found out there were more. So I raided the library, and that was it. I was hooked. But yeah, I grew up in the middle of a town, so I didn't get to see too many from my backyard. But once you get out of town, you get sold very quickly. It's amazing. And the caller's correct that when you get into a very dark sky, it's just an awe-inspiring experience. And we're not claiming that the Middle Fork River has the darkest sky in the United States, But a lot of it has to do with the efforts put into it. The fact that the Champaign County Forest Preserve District values the night sky as a natural resource. We want to protect all of our resources, but a lot of people don't include the night sky in that. So that's really one of the reasons for the designation.
Mary Ellen, you grew up in the Chicago suburbs, right? So I imagine that's also not a lot of night sky viewing there. Why
that's
do
right.
you, was preserving this important for you now?
Well, for me personally, and I think everybody can point to a dark sky experience that they have. And you're right, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago. And like you, the first time I really saw a star-filled sky was when I went to summer camp when I was probably 11 or 12 years old up in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan and walked outside that first night and looked
up. On
Mackinac
Island, it's beautiful, yeah.
It's just, I think I stood there in awe for, you know, a number of minutes. I just couldn't believe what I was seeing. I had no idea. And so the idea of future generations not having that experience was just something we couldn't allow to happen. And again, you know, it is Illinois, so you are only going to be able to get away from those developed areas so far. It's not, you're not going to have an Idaho experience probably. But it was important to us not only for the, you know, sort of the human factor, that awe factor, but also because wildlife. I mean, we're the Champaign County Forest Preserve District, and our part of our mission is to conserve wildlife, conserve natural resources. And a regular pattern of night and day is very important for wildlife, for wildlife to find food, to reproduce, to escape from predators. So we felt it was part of our mission. If there was something more we could do to preserve wildlife and to protect this natural resource, well, then it absolutely made sense for us to do
well,
that.
Well, I was thinking, as you're saying, that's really important for human wildlife too, right? When
we
think
absolutely.
About our sleep patterns
circadian
and
circadian rhythms, it's
right.
all very important. The production of melatonin, which is dependent on that dark night, has a lot of health benefits, and this, you know, you good sleep is important.
So for people who might want to come visit, what advice do you have for them, Mary Ellen?
I would say, you know, the preserve is open 24/7. One of when the Champaign-Urbana Astronomical Society goes up to hold their Star Watch activities, which they do in cooperation with our education staff, they typically set those up at our North Waterfowl area because it is furthest away from those lights at the campground. And that side of the preserve is open 365 days a year. You know, it might be a little cold this time of year to go up there at night, but we certainly put some, you know, heavy clothes on and go on up there. And, you know, set up. If you've got a telescope, that's great, but you don't even need that kind of equipment. You can just look up in the sky and see what you can see.
David, before we go, I wanted to just ask you about any important astronomical events coming up. And I think a lot of people, myself included, right now I'm just thinking about making it to December 21st, right? This is a time of year where there's so much darkness. I'm thinking about the solstice. But before that, we've got a comet that maybe might be visible, right? That might be an important thing to be looking for in the night sky, David?
Yeah, we have a relatively bright comet. And when I say that, you're still probably going to need binoculars. But if you're familiar with Orion the Hunter, it's sort of out in front of Orion the Hunter, and it's going to pass not too far from the Seven Sisters or the Pleiades star cluster here towards the middle of the month. So we've got that comet in the sky, it's like Wirtanen or something. I'm not sure how to pronounce its name. We also, next January, have a total lunar eclipse coming up, January 20th, somewhat prime time. It's going to start about 9:30 at night, and that's Martin Luther King Junior holiday weekend. So if kids aren't going to school on Monday, then maybe you could stay up a little bit on Sunday night and watch the eclipse.
Thanks for that. That's David Leake. He teaches astronomy and physics at Parkland College and also is the director of the Starkle Planetarium. I want to thank Mary Ellen Wallner for being with us as well, executive director of the Champaign County Forest Preserve. And we'll have all the information about this new area on our website at 21stshow.org. Mary Ellen, David, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
That does it for us today. That's all the time we have for. Coming up on tomorrow's program, Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin will be joining us. Do you have questions for him? You can leave us a voicemail at 217-300-2121. Again, that's 217-300-2121. We'll try to ask him. You can also tweet or email us your questions. Our Twitter handle, by the way, is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. And when we're not on the air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. All those links, if you want to leave us, as I said, a voicemail, send us an email, or follow us on social media, all you have to remember is our website, 21stShow.org. That's got all of our information for our Facebook and Twitter handles if you want to follow us there. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio. Vishesh Anand is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. And I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.